Thank you. Yes, it's a pleasure, of course, to be here at the Perimeter. My first time at Perimeter is very impressive, and it's very nice to give a talk at the Condensed Matter Room. So if you have any question during the talk, don't hesitate to ask me. This is a talk based on work that I've done with many people, so other people, including Olaya Travado, who's here in the audience. She herself, me, and my student Takato, we wrote kind of the initial paper that started the whole thing in the subject. And so the papers basically this is what we wrote originally. There was a paper written pretty much at the same time, doing pretty much the same thing in a different context. So I'm going to talk, about the ideas of these papers. Then there's a lot of work that's been going on in the last year on that subject, developing the subject. So as an advertisement, I should just say that I'm going to give some lectures in Lesouches summer school next year in August. So if you are interested, if you think your students should be interested, then you'll point them out to that. Okay? So this talk is actually something is lecture one
of
2018. Yeah, next year. Really, thank you. Okay, but in August 2017, perhaps July 2017 in Cargès, I gave basically this talk that I'm going to give you. So this is lecture one of these lectures that I gave. Okay, if we have time, I can do part of lecture two, but it's okay. That's what I thought. I thought just keep lecture one, and should be okay. So the first thing that I want to describe is what the problem is. And the problem is describing quantum systems, okay? Not any quantum system, but integrable quantum system, many-body integrable quantum systems. So of course, people have studied that for a long time, but I want to study this in non-equilibrium situations. So people have studied a lot of the thermodynamics, the ground states, all this stuff. Then I'm looking into the dynamics, and especially into situations that are inhomogeneous. Let me give you, describe for you some experiment that's been done, which is fully within that remit. Okay? Experiments called the quantum Newton cradle was done in 2006. Very well-known experiment in this context. Okay? What it is, well, they take some clouds of cold atoms, rubidium atoms. Okay? So they cool that up a lot. Okay? So they become clouds. The clouds go to some quantum states. They put that in some potential, transversal potential, that makes sure that the atoms are essentially one-dimensional. So it's a one-dimensional system, okay? Quasi-one-dimensional, almost. And another potential, which is harmonic, so it's kind of one-dimensional like that, but another potential, which is harmonic potential, that confines the cloud within some space in 1D. Okay? And then they hit this cloud with some laser pulses, some Bragg pulse, they call it. Okay? And then the clouds separate into two sets. One set of atoms goes to the right and the other goes to the left. Okay? Then they start oscillating like that. Okay? So two clouds of atoms, a lot of atoms, maybe, 300 or something like that, start oscillating. Okay? And so what do they do? Well, what they observe is that the atom oscillates, so they kind of far apart and they get nearer to each other, then they collide, two clouds of atoms collide, then they kind of go through each other and continue oscillating. Okay? So this is supposed to be surprising. Okay? Why? Because if you were to do the same thing in 3D, in higher D, and have really clouds of gas, of atom colliding, when they collide, they would just mix up, thermalize, and stop there. Right? Clouds of gas, two clouds of gas don't go through each other. They kind of interact. This is interacting atoms. They would mix up and then just stay there. While here, they kind of go through, they mix up, they do something, they interact here, but yet they go through and continue their motion. Okay? So they kind of made the parallel with the Newton cradle, which is these beads that are held by strings, and then you hit one side with one bead, and then the force is transmitted to the other side, and the other side starts moving like that, right? So it's a bit like that. They think how, somehow momentum is being transferred to the atoms, to the next cloud, and then they continue oscillating like this. So this is relatively surprising, so it says that there's something very special that happened in 1D which doesn't happen in higher D. Okay? And what they thought was that, well, this happens like that because the model that describes these cold atoms is integrable. Right? So it's a model that has infinitely many conserved charges, so it's a very special model, right, that you can solve exactly in certain situations. There are techniques, Bethe and Zass and all that. And they thought, well, probably because of the integrability, the integrability precludes the phenomenon of thermalization here. So they don't quite thermalize because it's terrible, because there are too many conserved charges, and allow the clouds, the two clouds here, to go through each other and to continue oscillating for a very long time. Right? So very nice. So that's fine. Okay, why not? Of course, the problem is that the model itself is called the Liebig-Binegger model that describes these cold atoms. This is integrable, but it is not integrable if you put it in the harmonic trap like this is. Here is a harmonic trap. So the harmonic trap breaks integrability. Yet this works out well still. So you don't quite know why this is so. Okay? And the other thing is that this whole thing is dynamical. This is not the ground state of, you know, this harmonic trap or anything like that. It's something that moves in space-time that is inhomogeneous now. This, and it was, there was no result about this kind of situation at that time in integrable systems. So this was kind of a guess, should be integrability, but it's not so clear exactly how it works out. Okay? So the point of my talk is basically to explain this experiment, let's say. Okay? Everything goes well, at the end I show some videos where we have a theory that reproduces that. Okay, let's see if everything goes well. Okay, questions about this experiment first.
Okay. You have a single cloud.
Yeah.
It will oscillate, but it will also thermalize at some point, or not?
So, there are different phenomena happening. So, it will oscillate. It will not oscillate forever and kind of be, you know, stable like that. These are interacting atoms and all that, okay? And so, there are two things that can happen. First of all, the potential is not exactly harmonic. There's some anharmonicity. And that mixes up the whole thing. Okay? And the other thing is that even in a really harmonic potential, the atoms do interact, and then they start mixing up. Now what is the final state of this whole thing? Actually, right now, I don't know. It is probably a thermal state of that thing. It's probably eventually thermalized, I think. But I'm not completely sure of that, so we have to investigate that. So you know, the lack of thermalization, I mean, you know, the harmonic potential does break integrability, actually. So. Yes, eventually you do expect that it will thermalize, but very large times.
If the time for thermalization would be very large, right?
Yeah.
Then you could think of each of these clouds as effectively one particle, right? So then you have like two particles. And if you have two particles, yeah. Even if you break integrability, when they scatter, they will conserve momentum and energy at the scattering point. So
yeah.
Then you would expect this, right?
No, but so, you know, they will, you know, the total momentum here, of you cannot really think of them as particles. So total momentum is zero, right? This goes to the right, it goes to the left. So when they interact and scatter with each other, suppose you're in higher D, they will scatter with each other and all that, the total momentum will still be zero. The momentum will just be redistributed around all these particles and will just form a gas that is essentially thermalized already there. I mean, it will do perhaps a little bit of motion and then will thermalize very fast, okay? So here the surprising thing is that this does not happen. So the momentum of each individual particle is like if it was conserved here, which is not quite the case. This is interacting.
I'll explain what I was saying. So I was saying that if for a single cloud, you don't see thermalization for a very long time.
Ah, yes. Yeah, so you think
then
that
a single cloud is like a single particle. Then if you have two single particles interacting,
yeah,
conservation of energy and momentum does imply that they are conserved.
Yeah, but I don't think it's quite the right analogy, because when they interact, they don't just exchange momentum and energy as two particles would do. You know, there's a lot of atoms in it. So I don't think the fact that... So you see, I don't know in higher D how long it would be for a single cloud, how long it would take for a single cloud to thermalize. Perhaps less long than that, but still kind of... a longer period, right? So I don't think it's quite what's happening. Yeah. Other questions? Yes.
So that experiment was at very low temperature,
yes,
so
yes.
Somehow there is no interaction with this environment.
So so there is interaction, but the interaction is rather simple. So it's kind of it can be approximated by a point-like interaction. So it's like, so the model, I think my next slide is the model. The model that approximates the interaction is that one. Okay, so you have, these are bosons, so you have bosonic motion, and then you have a kind of a density-density interaction. Okay?
I was thinking about environment.
Now, so environment, so it, in principle, this is isolated from environment. Now, in practice, not completely, that's true. So this is another effect, actually, that can lead to this. In principle, is as isolated as possible from environment. So all the phenomena of thermalization and all that are internal. This is isolated system, yeah. Okay. Yeah, other questions? So there it is. So this is the integrable model, okay, the Hamiltonian. It's a very simple form. So it's a field theory, which is non-relativistic, right? So Galilean invariant field theory. And this model is, well, certainly have some conserved charges, okay? So few of them are, well, the density of particle, the momentum, the energy, and then it has more, right? But here are the ones that one can write explicitly, of course, right? And there it is, right? So now we want to put this model in a potential. So basically, we want to do that. We have some initial state, which can be described as, say, very low temperature, so beta very large, if you wish, or even beta infinity, if you wish, state of this Hamiltonian plus a potential. Okay? So you couple the potential with the density of particles. Okay? So that's a very well-defined initial density matrix. And then you evolve the whole thing with a different Hamiltonian. So here is a simplification of that problem. I suppose I've thermalized with two blobs of particles separated. Like that. So I've taken an initial potential that has two minima, so that you separate the two clouds, if you wish. And then I evolve with a different potential that has a single minima, and two clouds will start evolving towards each other and moving around. Right? So that's a bit of a simplification of the problem, but that's fine as well. Okay? And so this is the problem. What is the time evolved average of whatever observable you want, say the density at position x and time t? Okay? So well-defined problem, and the question is how to solve that. Right? How can you compute time evolution of such quantum gas? Can we produce the effects in the quantum neutral cradle? How can we explain that? What are the general principles? Right? So the explicit form of the problem is very simple. You could, in principle, put that on a computer, but the computer is rather limited, and 300 particles is too much. Right? And so in principle, you could do that on a computer, but it can get very difficult, and you'd like to have the general principles that control that. Okay, so any questions? So the principles... Well, the basic idea here is the idea of hydrodynamics. Okay? So this is a gas of particles. So we know that hydrodynamics is a very powerful theory to describe gases of particles. Right? And so for this purpose, then let me remind you what the basic ideas of hydrodynamics are. And then let us try to apply these basic ideas to this system, right? And see what happens. Right? So hydrodynamics. Okay? So the hydrodynamics is you've heard of that, it's a very old theory, okay? And the basic ideas of hydrodynamics are very, very simple, actually. Okay? And here I'm going to describe for you conventional hydrodynamics, something that has been developed for a long time, really. Okay? So the basic idea of hydrodynamics is simply that you don't try to solve the whole problem, but you make some assumptions, some simplifying assumptions. And the first simplifying assumption is that you assume that locally, so around some local point in space and in time, there has occurred, equilibrium has been reached locally. So thermal equilibrium, thermodynamic equilibrium has been reached. Okay. So you assume there's this kind of separation of time scales. So something happens at large scale, time and space scale, things move around, but at very short scale, things thermalize very fast. Okay, separation of time scale. Okay. It's an approximation, but why not? And so what happens then? That means that locally you will have something that looks like a Gibbs ensemble. So here we have, we take the macrocanonical, the grand canonical ensemble, so the Hamiltonian, there's the number of particles that might fluctuate locally, and also the whole thing might be Galilean boosted, right? So you look at your gas somewhere where the gas may move somewhere, so you can just kind of change your frame to bring it to local equilibrium. So if it's boosted, that means that you add the momentum there. That's the boost. Okay? So it's a boosted Gibbs ensemble, more or less. Okay? These are the three conserved quantities that I described just previously. They are there in the model. We know exactly what they are. Okay? And the hydrodynamic approximation is simply saying that if you evaluate something that is local, a local observable, at space-time point xt in your initial state, so you've evolved from the initial state for time t, and you look at space-time point x, this is approximately equal to the average you would get in the Gibbs ensemble, which is itself xt dependent. Now, you don't know exactly what this Gibbs ensemble is, so you still have to determine its parameter, the inverse temperature, chemical potential, and all that, the boost, right? But Gibbs ensemble that xt dependent. So that's the hydrodynamic approximation. Okay? Yes?
Just a quick question. So when you write down this Gibbs ensemble with, say, beta as a function of x and t,
yeah.
You might very multiply it with full H, isn't it like multiplied
with
its density at point X?
No, it's a full H. So that's the approximation. So what you assume is that locally it thermalizes, and in these fluid cells, these are the local fluid cells, it's as if you had a homogeneous system. So this full H, you could understand it as being the H within the whole fluid cell. So there's fluid cell is like mesoscopic, right? It's much bigger than every macroscopic, but much smaller than the typical sizes of observations. Okay. So this is an approximation, right? So you take, so in that expression here, in that calculation, your whole system is homogeneous, right? You take a Hamiltonian, which is homogeneous, right? A number operator and a momentum, right? So you assume it's locally homogeneous, so this is implementing the homogeneity of the given sample, and now space-time dependence is put into the space-time dependence of this parameter. For instance, if you take the true initial state, which is not homogeneous, yes, it goes a bit slow. So true initial state, which is not homogeneous, okay? There's a V in EX, N of X, okay? What would be a hydrodynamic approximation? Well, the simple thing would say what would be to say that V of X actually varies very slowly in space. So locally, things are thermal. And so you could replace it, you could replace this initial asymmetric by a Gibbs ensemble that depends on X, where you put now V of X times N. No, V of X varies very slowly, so that integral, around a certain point, in that integral, you can extract your V in E outside, right? And then you end up with integration over X of N of X. So you end up with a fluid cell integration times a V in E that depends on a coordinate that specifies fluid cells. There's a scaling, a separation of scale. So this, from this, this is a separation of scale. Right? That's the approximation. So it's an approximation, physically based approximation, to show that this is indeed, this indeed occurs, you know, in some situations. It's actually very hard. There are not so many proofs. There are certain proofs based on Boltzmann equation, but Boltzmann equations is already an approximation or something. There's no proof, as far as I know, in non-trivial system of conventional hydrodynamics emerging from actual macroscopic interaction. Yeah, as far as I know, there's no proof of that. Okay? But it's an approximation. Other questions? Okay, so let's go. So this is what I'm saying. So you, things move in space-time, okay, but locally they look thermal with higher or lower temperatures. You have different chemical potential and the temperatures and all that. Now, how do you extract the dynamics? I didn't tell you what this Gibbs ensemble is, right? It depends on space-time, but what determines this dependence on space-time? This is hydrodynamics. And here, we don't need to make any other assumption. Almost need no other assumption. All we need to impose is the conservation laws. So we have conservation laws, we have conserved quantities, hence conserved densities, hence conserved currents, like the Noether currents, if you wish, right, of QFT. So for energy density, there's a conserved energy current that goes with it, right, dth plus dx, jh equals zero. Same thing for, so let's concentrate on energy density. Yeah, same thing for momentum density and particle density. Okay? So this is certainly true at the macroscopic level, this equation. There's no approximation here, that's for sure. Okay? Now let us use the hydrodynamic approximation with that equation. So how we do that? We say that instead of writing this equation in differential form, let us write it in integral form, integrate over some contour, and this take this contour large enough. Macroscopic contour, okay? So that goes through fluid cells and all that, macroscopic contour. If you integrate over a macroscopic contour, you can use the hydrodynamic approximation, assuming that this approximation is valid uniformly enough in the fluid. So you can replace everywhere your average by GG, by Gibbs ensemble that depends on XT, okay? So this equals that, and since this is zero, then you can rewrite this in a local form, okay? So here my kind of a straight H is the average in a Gibbs ensemble. So now you go from a local operator, say, equation, conservation equation, to a conservation equation for averages in Gibbs ensembles. Okay? It's important that here this dt dx is a macroscopic dt dx, while here dt dx is a macroscopic one, is from fluid cell to fluid cells. Because here I took a large contour to be able to apply the hydrodynamic approximation in a uniform way, okay? But it looks the same. It looks the same, but it's subtly different, okay? Okay? So this is an equation. Very good. So now we get an equation for averages in Gibbs ensembles. We have also equations for related momentum and momentum current and density of particle and current of density of particle, which is just the momentum density in that case, in Galilean case, okay? So we have these three equations, and we have five quantities, right? H, P, N, and two currents, okay? But remember that in the Gibbs state, there are just three parameters. There's the temperature, the chemical potential, and the boost, the Galilean boost. Three parameters. So there must be relation amongst these five quantities because these five quantities are all evaluated within a Gibbs ensemble. Right? There are just three parameters that specify the whole Gibbs ensemble. So there are two equations of state. This is usually called equations of state. Relations amongst between currents and densities in a term in an equilibrium state, the equation of state. Okay? So thermodynamics tells you what the equation of state are. In principle, you can evaluate these averages. Okay? For instance, you know, the current of momentum is basically the pressure, and that's the equation of state that relate the pressure to the energy density. And we know that pressure is related to energy density and particle density that characterizes your gas. Okay? So this is characteristic of the gas. Okay? So if you put that in there, you get three equations for three functions. The densities of energy, momentum, and particle. And there it is. Now you just have to solve that. And these three functions, you can take that complete characterization of your local Gibbs ensemble. Instead of the inverse temperature and all that, just take the average energy, momentum, and particle. Okay? And you just evolve them in space-time using, by putting these equations of state within these dynamical conservation equations. Okay? That's conventional hydrodynamics. Any questions about this? So it might not look exactly the way that you've seen it, but you can work things out in all this and find, if you define your V as being P over N, you find an equation that which is Euler's equation, maybe you remember from Landau, if you saw any other book on fluid dynamics, on hydrodynamics. Okay? So this is a standard hydrodynamic equation, just explained in a slightly different way than the books would do. Okay? So some comments, this is important. This is valid at the Euler scale. What does that mean? This is the largest scale possible. Okay? We know that in hydrodynamics, you have Navier-Stokes equation, which corrects that. Right? There are viscosity terms, corrects all the hydrodynamics equations. So here I don't have any viscosity terms. Okay? I've neglected that. Viscosity terms will be, in fact, higher derivative terms in here, which I have neglected. Okay? So I've assumed things are smooth enough. Okay? So this will be true at the larger scale possible, where you can neglect higher derivative terms, such as viscosity.
Sorry,
yes?
I don't quite understand. So the equations that you wrote are just conservation equations. So
yes.
They will be present even in the presence of the viscous terms, right?
So
it's just the constitutive relation will
be different. Yeah, yeah.
So zeros will still stay zeros on the right.
Yeah,
side.
So you can understand that. So you can say, well, the current is not quite what I thought it was.
So normally in the standard hydro, what you would do, you would modify the...
Yeah. That's for sure. Yeah, that's for sure. So the important bit is this with that, right? This is the Euler scale.
So basically, what you are describing, in viscous hydrodynamics.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's right. In viscous hydrodynamics in one dimension. Now, viscosity is interesting, but I don't have results about viscosity, so I keep with what I know. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so this is that. So actually, people have applied this kind of idea to the problem I started talking about at the beginning, and it kind of works, but not super well. So you can do conventional hydrodynamics on the Liebig-Dinger model. You know the equation of states; it's calculable by Bethe and Zatz. Okay? So you do your calculation, crank the crank, you know, do something on the computer, and it kind of works, but partially. It works quite well. Sometimes it doesn't work quite well. Now we understand why. Okay, so just a little picture of what we're actually doing. You know, to go to inhomogeneous dynamical, all you have to go is from your Gibbs ensemble to hydrodynamics. There's not more information here, right? Viscosity would be additional function. There's no more information than thermodynamics in there, because it's Euler scale. Okay, but so certainly the Liebig-Dinger model is integrable, so there are more conserved quantities. Okay? There's infinitely many of them. I don't know how to write them explicitly. In fact, nobody knows how to write these conserved quantities explicitly. The first non-trivial one, I think that there are some expressions, but the other ones, you know, there's no one doesn't know. Okay, but one thinks that they exist. Okay? It's a bit of a one thinks that they exist because it's integrable. Okay, so they exist. So in integrable models, turns out that things don't generically relax to Gibbs ensembles. Gibbs ensemble is not the right concept. Okay? Very simple way of thinking about that. Let's change the problem a little bit now and go to something that's completely homogeneous. You have some initial density matrix and let it evolve in time with the Hamiltonian for which this initial density matrix is not stationary. It's just a thing evolve in time. Okay? So you have some initial density matrix and you evolve in time like that and you want to see what happens. And then you ask, so what is the large time limit of that? So if your system is really, 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 really large, It's like, you know, so you start with some eigenstate of some Hamiltonian in a very large system and evolve with a different Hamiltonian. In the normal case, you would expect that as things evolve, you know, the system will thermalize. So it's like when you hit your system, change its state, and then let it evolve for a long time. It will eventually come back to some thermalized state, maybe at a higher temperature, right? So things should thermalize, and so the question is, what happens if you look locally in this very large system? Does it look thermal, right? So this is a thermalization problem. Of course, if you look globally and evolve an isolated system, it cannot thermalize because it's a unitary evolution. Okay? But if you look locally, you can think of the rest of the system as acting a bit like a bath, so it could thermalize. It could. So that's the question, right? In the usual cases, one would expect it does thermalize. But in an integrable system, because of infinitely many conserved quantities, it's very easy to see that any conserved density in the initial state is actually time independent. Because you do the time derivative of that is the x derivative of the current, and this is zero if the whole thing is homogeneous. Right? So you have infinity number that characterizes, that can calculate in the initial state and that characterizes the final state after a long time evolution. Right? And so it cannot be that the final state is just described by a Gibbs ensemble. Gibbs ensemble does not have enough parameters to describe everything. Okay? So the assumption that has been made is that what you get is something called a generalized Gibbs ensemble, where what you put in the exponential is all the conserved charges. So it's very natural, if you wish, you just sum of all the conserved charges. The idea is that you maximize, so locally you will try to maximize entropy, but maximize entropy with respect to our local conservation laws, which is the thing that makes sense of somehow, that is natural. Okay, so what it says is that if you have a very large homogeneous system and time evolve it locally at very large time, the local observable will be described by a generalized Gibbs ensemble with all these inverse temperatures, right? Infinitely many inverse temperatures. Right? This has been observed in antically, numerically, in integrable systems, so there's quite a lot of literature on that, and it's very well established that this is the case. Right? Any question about this? Yes. So this is a phenomenon of generalized thermalization. Right? I want to pass that. So here what I'm saying is, instead of having a Gibbs ensemble, if you have an integrable system, you have a generalized Gibbs ensemble. So instead of having the sum of Hamiltonian number of particle momentum, you have all the possible conserved charges that appear in the exponential. Right? So now we want to just connect that with the hydrodynamic principle. So we see that locally in this large fluid cell, so I could think of that now as my large fluid cell, which is almost homogeneous, and see what happened, you know, kind of evolve within that and see there's a separation of scale. So there's a scale in which now local thermalization happens. Okay? So locally, with this large fluid cell, you're going to have not thermalization, but generalized thermalization. Okay? So you have now, the approximation is that a local observable at space-time point xt is going to be more or less well described by a trace with the xt-dependent GGE, generalized Gibbs ensemble. So with infinitely many xt-dependent parameters. Okay? And I have, of course, infinitely many conservation laws, so infinitely many conserved densities and conserved currents, both of them evaluated within, you know, the GGEs, and I write this conservation equation. Right? So this is my earlier scale hydrodynamics for integrable system, kind of the naive way of doing that. Right? And I have also infinitely many equations of state. I should have, right? I have an infinite set of beta I, and I have two infinite sets, right, qi and ji, so one should be related to the other. Of course, it's a bit more tricky to count infinity, but one assumes it's okay. So how the ji, the current, should be related to the qj, the qi, the densities, by infinitely many equations. Okay, this time. And this equation of state are the things that characterize the model. In principle, are calculable if you can calculate this kind of trace with the exponential of all the conserved charges. Okay? So this is generalized hydrodynamics. Okay? So any questions about this?
Sorry, I have a silly question. So So in presumably in some model where you can construct these higher order conservative charges, they would correspond to higher gradients, higher derivatives.
Yes.
So, but somehow you are still using an approximation.
Local,
right, so you are neglecting whiskers terms and all the other ones for
Low
conserved charges, but keep, on the other hand, keep all of these things.
Yes, so that's a good point, of course. So if I write, that's why the whole thing is rather naive, right? If I write this is an infinite sum, these conserved charges, higher and higher derivatives, if you wish. If you resum that, you could write explicitly in a free theory form. So if you resum that, in principle, you get something that's not local at all. Depending on the betas, it can be extremely non-local. Okay? So you have to characterize the space of GGEs correctly. Okay? And this is non-trivial. Okay? There's a way, actually, of characterizing the space of G. What's in instead of this sum, okay, you can think of that as a single conserved charge living in a big space. And what characterizes that space is the concept of pseudo-locality. So there's a locality concept that characterizes a space. And I have a proof, mathematically rigorous proof, that the thematization process leads you to that space. So it's not any conserved charge that's arbitrarily non-local. It's all that are, in quote, pseudo-local. So there's a definition of what pseudo-local is. So there's a certain type of locality there. Okay? So locality, there's a certain type of locality that remains there. Right? And the space of pseudo-local charge is basically a Hilbert space. And the local one, or the ones that are not too non-local, so it depends a bit on the model, they form a basis. And this sum should be convergent. So there's a convergence property that goes in here. And so you could truncate it if you wished and get something rather precise. And if you truncate it, then you don't have any of these problems. Then it comes back to something local, or at least.
So I would expect that. There should be some sort of truncation. In
yes, part. Exactly. So, of course, this should be convergence. It should be possible that you truncate it and still it's good approximation for the whole thing to make sense. And this is the case. So I have a mathematical proof of this summarization stuff, but there are a lot, before my proof, there was a lot of calculations, numerical, analytical models showing that, yes, if you truncate, it works pretty well. You just have to truncate in the right way. Okay. So yeah, so that's a good question, and of course that is a kind of a bit under the carpet here, so we don't. But there's something behind, yeah. Okay, other questions? And so the idea is just that to do this now. So basically that's the big picture, right? We know how to go from Gibbs to hydrodynamics. We just put things space time independent, and we know how to go from Gibbs to generalized Gibbs ensembles. So we put these two things together, and we get GAG now. In this form is absolutely useless because even in the Leibniz model, we have no idea what these QI look like. So we have to do something more clever. Okay? So the more clever thing is to use the quasi-particle formulation of GGE. So this is basically what is called the thermodynamic Bethe ansatz. Okay? So I'll describe that just without going into details because thermodynamic Bethe ansatz can be very technical. Okay? But let me give you the main points. Okay? So the main point here is that in the thermodynamic Bethe ansatz, so we imagine representing the state by quasi-particles. So any state is formed by putting quasi-particles. They're not real particles. They're related to real particles in some complicated way. This is the Bethe ansatz. Okay? But you put quasi-particles, and every quasi-particle is characterized by a momentum or something called a spectral parameter. Okay? So in this state, you put as many quasi-particles as you want with different spectral parameter. Spectral parameter can encode also the internal quantum number, momentum, and all that. Okay. And so it's a bit like the scattering state of quantum field theory. It's very closely connected to that, but it works even without scattering state. This is kind of Bethe ansatz. Okay. And there are various things that characterize the model. So what is the space of spectral parameters? Maybe it's the real line corresponding to all possible momenta, for instance. But this is a spectral parameter, so how does it relate to the actual physical momentum, to the energy, and there's another quantity called the artificial scattering phase that determines how these particles interact with each other. Okay? So these are the quantities that are input of the TBA, okay? And that allow you to construct everything. Okay? So I don't tell you exactly where it comes from, exactly this. The scattering phase, it describes, the scattering, it's related to the scattering matrix and all this, but this is just kind of data that you take that defines your model and that allows you to calculate thermodynamic stuff, okay? Okay, So for instance, in Galilean invariant model, your momentum is just, you can just take E and theta, so theta is like the velocity, energy is m theta squared over 2. In relativistic model, you could take theta as the rapidity, and then you have a relativistic expression relation. And in these cases, if you just have a single particle, then this phi is nothing else but the differential, the logarithmic derivative of the scattering, the two-body scattering matrix. And in integral models, you don't need anything else than the two-body scattering matrix to describe all the scattering phenomena. Okay? So, okay. So this is something that is kind of given for the model that you have. Okay? Now, what can you calculate from this? Well, it turns out that the conserved charges, they are very easy to calculate. You can think of that as every quasi-particle carrying its own conserved charge. Okay? So Qi, acting on a state with many quasi-particles, is just the sum of all the value of this conserved charge on every quasi-particle. For instance, the energy, of course, would be just the total energy. Momentum would be total momentum, but this holds also for all other conserved charges. Okay? So here we can forget about what Qi looks like. All we have to concentrate on is what this one particle eigenvalue Hi is. And this is what characterizes now the conserved charges. So we don't need to have the explicit form in space, you know, integration dx and all that. All we need is Hi. Okay? So in fact, all we need is the space of such Hi. Okay? And then if you do the GGE, so you go in the thermodynamic limit, what you think of is simply that you have a state with many, 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 many quasi-particles with finite density on infinite volume, on very large volume. Okay? And so you describe this by giving a density of particle. So basically, volume times rho p theta d theta is the number of quasi-particles between theta and theta plus d theta. Okay? So you have a lot of particles and you kind of put some kind of density of this. Okay? And this is, so this rho p is what characterizes the GGE. So forget about the beta I that I told you about, just think about rho p. Just put all these quasi-particles, you know, with various density of spectral parameters, and this is what characterizes your whole GGE. Right? So if I want to calculate the average of some particle local density, which is that trace, right, in principle, well, this is 1 over L, the trace of the full, of the total charge, Qi, and then if you put these equations, in, it comes back to an integration, because you have a finite density of the integration of all rapidities, the one particle eigenvalue of this charge times the density of particle in there. Okay? So this relation, I told you some words for where it comes from, is something that is actually derived non-trivially in integrable system literature. And you can take that as some very basic relation that allows you to calculate conserved densities knowing what the GGE is. So the density of particle for as per spectral parameter specifies now your GGE, you put it in there, and then you know what the conserved densities are. Okay? So that tells you how to calculate one thing. So instead of the Qi then, or instead of the beta I, you can think of the rho p of theta as characterizing the GGE. Okay? And that's the variable we're going to take now to characterize our GGE and to see how it evolves in space-time. Okay? So any questions about this? Yeah? So this is really just a kind of overview, very quick overview of what TBA is, but that's the main equation. The density of quasi-particles, from this you can calculate conserved densities. I just give you an example with the Liebig-Naeger model, the one we're interested in. Okay? The one particle eigenvalues, of course, for energy and momentum are very simple, and phi is known, this differential scattering phase is known from the literature, it has this particular form. Okay? So this is in a repulsive regime, which is a physically relevant regime. The attractive regime is a different picture, there are different particle types and all that, but you know, we can concentrate on this. So this, all this data is known, so we can do something with it. Yeah.
So these quasi-particles, do you think of them or do you treat them quantum mechanically? Because after all, you're talking about them
yes.
scattering and so on.
Right? Yes, yes. So
you do think of them, but on the other hand, you're thinking about the density matrix corresponding to the corresponding density matrix as
yeah.
a state with infinite number of such particles.
Yes.
As long as the density is.
Yes, that's right. That's how I think of that. Yeah.
So that means that the representation where it's quantum mechanics is not a Fock representation.
Well, it turns out actually that you can use a Fock representation for the cell state. It's just kind of, I mean, like the usual computation relation now is modified by a scattering matrix. But it is actually equivalent to a Fock representation, it turns out.
It is equivalent.
Yes, but there is a scattering matrix there that is there. And that has an influence, actually. So it's not it's a modification, let's say, of the Fock representation, if you wish. Okay? So indeed, the way to think about all this is you have a finite density of particles, large volume, and you think of them quantum mechanically, so what you would like to do is to construct a wave function with that. You want the wave function to be well-defined, say, on the circles. You think of a particle going around the circle, scattering all these particles. It gets all kind of phases, and you ask for this wave function to be kind of well-defined on circles. So this product of phases should be equal to 1, and that gives the Bethe-Ansatz equation. So the quantum mechanical thing is all within the Bethe-Ansatz equation, right? And it takes into account that differential scattering phase, which is kind of a modification of the Fock space, or a modification of the standard canonical commutation relation. Okay, so it's a modification of that, let's say. Okay, and this modification then comes into all the equations that I'm going to write. So this phi plays an important role, and it comes from that modification of the canonical commutation relations. Okay, other questions? Yeah. So as an example of where it comes from, so if I could calculate the free energy is an important quantity, right? And in free model, it looks like that, where this epsilon is just the energy. Would look like that. In free model, this is the free energy in a free fermionic model, for instance. Okay, this is the energy for a single fermionic species, and you sum over all these fermionic species. In interacting model, this epsilon is not quite the energy because of this interaction, because of this fact I told you that, you know, you modify the commutation relation. Turns out that you've got this epsilon is related to the energy. Well, here is not just the energy because there's all these other and there's temperatures, okay? So this thing that's an exponential, it's a modification of that by this other term. So basically you have to solve a nonlinear integral equation to calculate this epsilon. And that comes from the interaction. You see there's a phi in there, and that's the interaction. Okay. Okay, and so that allows you then to calculate the QI in terms of free energy. So that relates for you what allows you to calculate the relates the QI to the betas that I had before, okay? So just as an example. Okay, so that's the setup we have. Now we have the average densities, but we don't have the average currents. So come to the average currents now. So the average currents should be, again, linear functional of this HI, one particle eigenvalue, but it should be some non-trivial function of the state, rho P. Now, rho P is characterized as a state, okay? For convenience, let me write this as some non-trivial function of the state, which I call VF, times rho P. Just for convenience, okay? It's called the effective velocity. Okay? The picture is just that you think you have some particles at theta, and you put a velocity to them, and that gives a current. Okay, that's the picture. Okay? You multiply velocity, that gives a current. So we have shown that indeed the currents in GGE can be calculated in this way, where VF solves a particular integral equation. Is that integral equation? Okay? Turns out, so we can derive this. So how to derive this is a bit more tricky. I mean, there's a simple argument using crossing symmetry. It can be checked with form factors. It's been checked numerically in XXZ chain. So it's quite a relation has been checked a lot. But there's no general derivation of that in general integrable system. In linear algebra, we do have. But in integrable system, more generally, we don't know how to derive this. While all the rest, we know how to derive. All the TBA, we know how to derive. Okay. So now we have the currents and the densities. I'll express in terms of the GGE, the density of particle, okay? And so we can, in principle, write our GHD equation, right? So, any questions about this one? Yeah? So let me, I don't want to go too much on the technicality, but there's one function which I really should introduce called the occupation function. Physically, is the ratio of a particle density over the state density. In a quantum, this integrable quantum model, the state density is a non-trivial function. It depends on the particle density. It involves the interaction, so there's an integral equation that relates these two things. And there's also a dressing operation that is an operation that is applied on functions that depends on this occupation function. So there are kind of relations there you can write. So instead of rho p, I can think of the occupation function as characterizing the state as well. Okay? So there's some a bit of technicality, but it's actually an important thing, this occupation function. It's just another function within TBA that characterizes the state. Okay? So Now, let's go to GHD. So what do we do in GHD? Things become space-time dependent, right? So the GGE, which is this function, now becomes space-time dependent. Okay? So rho p now becomes rho p of xt theta, or this other n function that I introduced becomes n of xt theta. So these are two equivalent representations of the GGE. Now it becomes space-time dependent. And we know how to represent our qi and our ji in terms of rho p, now this, and we know what the GHD equations are, is this. Okay? So we just have to write these equations with this representation. Now, what is really nice, so the powerful bit here, okay, the reason why I did all that, is that we can now, so we don't have to know what these one particle eigenvalues are, we don't have to know what the qis are, all we have to assume is that this hi of theta from in some way a complete set of function. And if on a complete set of function, I can translate this space-time equation into equation just for rho p and vf rho p, just canceling the hi integration over theta. So I get that equation. Right? So this is the basic equation of GHD in the quasi-particle language. Right? Now this is an explicit equation I can put on a computer, solve, and once I know what rho p is, I can now calculate whatever I want using the TBA formulas that have been established a long time ago. Right? I can calculate densities of whatever constant charge I want. Okay? Density of particle, density of energy, for instance. Right? So this is the fundamental GHD equation, which in principle I just have to solve and calculate something out of that. Questions about this one? Yeah? So that kind of combines the mechanics of TBA with the idea of hydrodynamics. Okay, so this equation can actually be written in different ways. I'll skip that one. I just want to write the other equation in terms of this other variable. N, the VF comes out of the derivative, surprisingly. And in this form, this N then can be identified with a Riemann invariant or normal mode of the GHD. This is a concept in hydrodynamics, which choosing the right hydrodynamic variable, your earlier equations can be written in a much simpler form. You kind of diagonalize the hydrodynamics. This n diagonalizes it, and these effective velocity are the eigenvalue of some of your hydrodynamic equations. Okay? So this says that this occupation function is convectively transported by the fluid at these velocities. That would be the hydrodynamic interpretation of this. Okay, so we can generalize that, importantly, to the presence of a force field, because we want to have a force field for thing to move. Okay? So if you have a force field, you can replace your E of theta by an x-dependent E of theta, and now the formulas that I had stay the same. Okay, so you don't remember all the formulas, but I can tell you, all the formulas I had with where there's an E of theta in it stay the same, you just have to put E of x theta. And the equation now has a theta derivative term. It's like a velocity derivative, which is perfectly natural. When you have a force term, then velocities change. So the force term implies an acceleration, and the acceleration brings a velocity derivative. Right? The acceleration, it's an effective acceleration, which can be calculated in terms of the force, which is the space derivative of the energy, and other quantities, and with some dressing operation. So this is really like F equals ma, but kind of a bit more complicated situation. Okay? So there are equations for generating force field, and so now what I have to do is to solve this and solve the problem. Okay, so any question about this?
You didn't break integrability at this stage.
So this is a good question, and of course within the force field you break integrability. But what do we assume here? So this is a comment that I wanted to make here. This is order scale hydrodynamics. Okay, so it's valid assuming that fluid variables and external fields are varying only on very large scales. So locally, you still have terminalization in something that looks homogeneous. So we cover integrability. Okay? Locally, you preserve integrability. Well, of course, when you solve this equation, the charges that were conserved previously are no longer conserved on the whole system because of that term. Yet you can derive this equation. I should say, the equation without force term I derived for you very, very simply. This equation is much more complicated to derive. You have to use a bit more subtle arguments because of that, because you break integrability, so you have to use computators and all that and derive this. Okay? And then the question is, what happens when you solve this equation at a very large time? Do you get something that's thermal? Can you get something that's more general? This I don't know. Okay. one thing I can say for sure is that the solution where, you know, you if the evolution in energy is something with some potentials like that, then the hydrodynamic approximation of the Gibbs state with respect to that energy, which is something like this, is a stationary solution of the force equation. So it can be that the system goes to that. So the, you know, the thermal state of the evolution Hamiltonian is a stationary state of these equations, which is fine, which is good. But there might be more stationary states. This I don't know. So I want to finish with, let's see, the Newton cradle setup that I told you at the beginning. So what we're actually doing here is implementing a Bragg pulse. We have an initial distribution in a Hamiltonian potential, and then put a Bragg pulse, implement that in, within this thermodynamic beta and that. And we just solve this equation. So let me show what it looks like when you solve these equations. So this is in a Hamiltonian potential. You see, yeah. And okay, so there it goes. So things start oscillating, the two kind of blobs of gas oscillating, go through each other, and indeed don't thermalize. But as you see, things are not completely periodic, right? It kind of, the shape changes a little bit after many oscillations. And eventually, you know, where will it go? Well, it go to something that maybe is thermal, or I don't know yet exactly where it will go, okay? But so it's not quite periodic, but very nearly. And the two blobs of gas go through each other. So it kind of looks very much like what we see in the experiment. Okay, so if we go to an harmonic potential, then things are a bit more interesting. So this is not harmonic, it's anharmonic. So there's an harmonicity that makes the whole gas look like, you know, going to something stationary much faster. There's a remaining oscillation in the center at the end, because in the center it's still harmonic, it's just the side that are less harmonic. Okay, so this a bit of a representation of anharmonicity in the experiment. And you can also simulate other things. Here it's a simulation of a density kind of a bump initially, and then you let the whole thing expand. So that's kind of a release of a gas within some non-trivial density. And they have two bumps that go out like that, and it looks like it wants to form a shock, like in usual early hydrodynamic, but then the shock dissolves into something different. And this lower picture here is actually the effective Fermi points. So this is a zero temperature calculation, and then it turns out that effective Fermi points that evolve, for which you can write a hydrodynamic equation, and this, you know, produce that evolution. So let me show you other little pictures, because they're quite nice. So if you do, so this was just evolution in space, okay, of the density. If you do a spectral picture, so you look at space and spectral. So let's see, the horizontal line is the position, the horizontal axis, and the vertical axis is theta. Okay? Then you see these two blobs. So you have you know, two blobs that start at the same position, but that are suddenly separated into right moving and left moving blobs. And then they start evolving and actually turn around each other in space-time. This is the harmonic case, and this is the anharmonic case. In the anharmonic case, they modify their shape quite a lot. And more interestingly, you can look at what happens at very large time. So this was just a single period of the harmonic potential, a single period, right? At very large time, so here I look at period 0, 2 period, 4 period, 6 period, so up to 10 period. Then things, you see how things, well, first of all, how the blobs are not, don't exactly come back to the original position after one period. They actually slow down as they go to each other because of the interaction. So there's an effect of interaction. Right? You can see also that there are more and more particles in, at low velocity. This is again, an effect of interaction. So some kind of diffusive effect of interaction as the particles go to each other. Right? And in the anharmonic case, things get kind of smoother and look like stationary much faster because of the anharmonicity. Okay? But in neither case, we have reached the actual stationary state. I don't know exactly what the stationary state is. It's very hard to determine. I mean, certainly here not. But here also things still move, like particles still go towards lower and lower velocity. And I suspect that at very large time, we'll see something that has thermalized in the evolution potential. You know, basically like implementing the breaking of integrality. But at very large time scale. Okay. So this is the numerical results of just solving this equation and getting this. So we'll stop here. I think I'm pretty much end of my time. So there are many questions. For instance, how do you solve these equations? Okay, this is rather non-trivial. We have developed various ways to solve these equations. At lab, we have developed a molecular dynamics that represents this equation. So you can just take classical particles that interact with each other, and that should solve this equation. So that should represent the same Euler hydrodynamic as the quantum system. This is how this data is obtained. There's also a solution by characteristic that works without force term and all that. There's also some very special thing that happens at zero temperature that allow us to fully explain why some of the previous calculations worked pretty well and why they failed where they failed. Okay? So like in the formation of shocks and all this. And these equations, GAG equation, actually are much more general than quantum systems. So I presented this for quantum system like Leibniz. They work also for classical system like soliton gases and hard rod gases that people have developed in the past. For classical field theory as well, you can use GAG to describe classical field theory for classical lattice model. So it's extremely wide application. Exactly that formulation with the quasi-particle works in really a wide range of problems. And so some of the open questions, let's see if I can get to the final. Some of the open question would be, calculating the viscosity effects, which we haven't calculated, and is a very important, not really open questions. Looking at the statistic of current, or transfer of particles, and so improving the emergent hydrodynamics using integrability technique, perhaps. And it's kind of a lot of questions related to the hydro or to deriving these equations from in a more rigorous fashion. Yeah. So thank you for your attention.
Thanks. Are there any more questions?
Yeah. I have one. So I did not understand a very basic thing, which is what happens if you don't have the generalized Newton symbol? What happens if you don't have an integral model underlying everything? So then you have hydrodynamics.
Yes. Just emotional, yeah.
How, I'm used to trying to simulate quantum systems, quantum theories.
Yes.
And I never get to a clear point where it's obvious that I can use this approximation.
Yes. So the problem is that you're not able to reach hydrodynamics because your techniques don't work for that. It's too complicated. But it's what one expects. So you take some non-integrable QFT or lattice model, and you let it evolve in this inhomogeneous situation, right? And it evolves for a large enough time, things become smooth and all that. And then at some time, conventional hydrodynamics should correctly describe the dynamics of that. But I don't know of any numerical technique that can reach this point.
So this is not real. With an experiment with this quantum neutral cal.
Yes.
And that particular experiment.
Yes.
Relies or the phenomenon, what we see in the experiment relies on the fact that there is an integral.
Yes, it does. Yes.
That.
Yes.
So what if the theory was not integral?
Then so they have done the check of that, like they take the same atoms in higher D, and you evolve the whole thing, and then when the two blobs of gas meet, they basically thermalize immediately.
Higher D, but higher D may bring in lots of things. So if you bring 1D.
Yeah, you could do it in 1D as well, correct. So you could do 1D similar things and just break integrability, and it should just thermalize like that.
Right.
And it should be possible to describe that with conventional hydrodynamics. If you do the conventional hydro of this thing, it breaks. I mean, it just doesn't work when the clouds collide. Okay, there's shocks and all kind of things. And eventually you do have to introduce viscosity, create entropy, and eventually things thermalize. Right? So it just doesn't work. Right?
So that's what's the essence of integrability that makes the two.
Yes. What is the essence? Yes. So the basic thing is you have too many conservation laws. So
I mean, is it then what Pedro was suggesting at the beginning, or is it something else? Pedro was suggesting that we can think of that as two independent particles.
It's not quite two independent particles, but
you disagree with that. So.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to think of it exactly that way because there is interaction, and you could use this picture like to in a non-integrable case, and it just wouldn't work. But it's a little bit like that, if you wish. I mean, so these conserved charges, you can see the conserved charges as being the set of all quasi-momenta. So it's like there's some emerging particles, not the true particle, but some emerging particles, some combination of these two particles, which act a bit like particles. Okay? And these, they preserve their momenta. These preserve the momenta as they go through. The particles themselves don't exchange the momenta all the time. But these do preserve the momenta. So these emerging particles, we don't observe them in the experiment. Right? But we can calculate them. And that's why, as things go through, you don't have optimization. All these momenta are preserved. They preserve the momenta, but it's a bit like soliton scattering. If you have two soliton in classical field, they go through each other and they come out unchanged, preserve the momenta, but they have moved a little bit. There's a bit of delta x, right? So same thing here, actually. These quasi-particles, they go to each other, they preserve them not, but they move a little bit. And this motion, this little bit of motion, is what is the effect of interaction, and is what makes, for instance, the two clouds, when two clouds go to each other, they have been slowed down a little bit. It's this little motion, you know, of these quasi-particles. But this is a quasi-particle picture. It's not real particles, right? So it's really, it includes all the interactions and all the effects of interability.
In the case that you said that even in one dimension it would thermalize,
yes.
What would happen for a single cloud?
Yes, I don't know, yes. You would ask, what would be the, so it should thermalize at some point, and what would be the time scale for that?
Yeah, I'm just
much
that when
smaller.
It thermalizes in one dimension, it should not depend on the fact that you have two clouds scattering. Just one cloud by itself, the self-interactions should allow it to thermalize, right?
Yeah, so...
And when one cloud does not thermalize, the intuition would be that cloud is a little bit like a classical soliton that you are describing.
Yeah.
And there is an effective description of it as a classical soliton. And then when you have two of those, if they are stable by themselves...
Yeah, but they are not stable, but they're not quite stable. So they're not...
They cycle several times until disintegration, right?
I think more precisely, it's not a classical soliton. It's a whole gas of classical solitons. This is what it is. It's a gas of classical solitons. So it's not quite stable by itself, but every little classical soliton is itself stable. In fact, this theory that I described is exactly the theory that people... the equation that we have obtained now, people have obtained the same equations in a completely different context, the context of looking at a macroscopic number of solitons of classical fields interacting with each other, same equation. So really this is like classical solitons. In fact, what we've discovered is that, if you take an integrable quantum system and make wave packets of a certain quasi-particles, the quasi-particles, you cannot really create it as a stable thing, but you can make a wave packet of it. The wave packet is not quite stable, right? It expands now. That, but if you take two of these wave packets and let them go through each other, they come out a little bit changed, okay? But you know, not too changed, and with a small delta x, kind of the center has been modified a little bit, okay? Like classical soliton, but not exactly like, because classical solitons are stable, okay? But just with delta x, like a classical soliton, and the equations we have is exactly the equations that classical soliton gas people have for that delta x. So the equations for a quantum gas, right, is like the classical gas of its own soliton-like feature. Okay? Or it's a gas, not just a single soliton. It's quite important. Okay? Another question?
So have you thought about what the entropy current would be in this picture?
Yeah, so here we are at the Euler scale, so entropy is conserved. Scale. So now the question here is, what is the entropy? There's an entropy in TBA called the Yang-Yang entropy, so you can calculate an entropy in TBA. Maybe it's the correct one, maybe not for physical purposes, this is another question, but certainly this one is conserved at the Euler scale. And what we would expect is that, so there's a conserved current, basically, of entropy of that, so this is conserved. What we expect is that with a viscosity term, this entropy will be treated, so it will be positive. Okay? The question is to find the right viscosity that will make this entropy go up. And yeah, it's not quite known. But yeah, so entropy has been looked at. Other questions?
No more questions? Thank you very much. One and a half week more here? Right?
Yes.
So if you have more questions, go ahead.
Thank you.